Live in Boston.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. America in the mid-50s was gripped by fear of communists, of the A-bomb, of polio, and of non-conventional sex, a fear that reached new dimensions in Sioux City, Iowa. In 1955, this western Iowa city was the scene of the brutal death of 8-year-old Jimmy Bremers and the gruesome rape, torture, and murder of 18-month-old Donna Sue Davis. The state responded to the ensuing panic by enacting a sexual psychopath bill and incarcerating 35 innocent, mostly homosexual men to a mental institution as a form of preventive detention. Do you find echoes of the sex crime panic of the 1950s in today's headlines? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. We're joined in the studio by Neil Miller. He's a lecturer in journalism and nonfiction writing at Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts, and author of Sex Crime Panic, A Journey to the Paranoid Heart of the 1950s. Welcome, Neil Miller.
A pleasure, Jack.
Neil Miller, set us up. You tell the story here of two injustices. Both share one thing in common. Homophobia, fear of homosexuals. First of all, the story of the man who was charged with one of these crimes, and of course, secondly, the story of the homosexuals who were rounded up and sort of put off the street.
Right. In a sense, there are two stories here. After the murder in the summer of 1954 of 8-year-old Jimmy Bremers, a drifter named Ernest Triplett was brought in under suspicion of being the criminal. And he wound up in a mental hospital on his own volition, where he was given various drugs, including LSD, as a truth serum to try to get him to confess to the crime, which he eventually did. He was convicted during a trial in which his marijuana smoking, his bisexuality, and the confession, above all, were enough to put him in jail. And in the wake of Triplett's conviction, in the wake of Jimmy Bremer's death, the state passed this sexual psychopath law, which then led to the roundup of these other gay men. Triplett himself served 15 years in jail until all this information about drugs came out and he was released in the early 70s.
What is a sexual psychopath?
According to Iowa law and the law of 25 other states, in Iowa, it was anyone who was who was arrested for a public offense, who was believed to have a propensity to commit sex crimes. And at that time, homosexuality or sex between men was against the law. It was considered a sex crime. So therefore, if you were a gay man and you had this propensity, you could be classified as a sexual psychopath if the district attorney, let's say, asked a judge to do so, which he did in the wake of the death of little Donna Sue Davis, which was a year after the first crime. They couldn't solve this murder. There was sort of a clamor in the entire state to do something about it. The governor announced that they were setting up a special ward for criminal sexual psychopaths at Mount Pleasant Hospital, which was a state mental hospital. They wanted to fill the ward, and apparently they couldn't figure out how to bring in some real violent sexual predators. So they rounded up some 20 gay men in Sioux City, and they were put in this special ward.
And they were, and the idea was they were going to be cured there. Was this enlightened?
Yeah, that was part of it. That they were going to be there indefinitely until cured. That was according to the law, and that was the program in mind. And nobody ever thought that these guys had any connection to the death of this little girl. Mm. It was simply, we're cleaning up the city. They're all sexual deviants. Gay men are sort of lumped in with violent sexual predators. And this is kind of a way of assuaging the public, which was quite terrified in the wake of these two child murders.
So the political element here was so clear.
There's definitely a political element. There's a young county attorney who's the district, that's what they call a district attorney out there. He was young. He was ambitious. I think he saw this was a way of gaining popularity and satisfying the public demand for something to be done.
Mm. I'd like to introduce from our Providence studio tonight's news analyst, Lewis Gordon. He's director of Africana Studies at Brown University. Hello, Lewis.
Hello there.
We're just listening sort of to a portrait of enlightened psychiatry, I guess, in the 1950s. We've
Indeed.
Been here before, haven't we?
Oh, yes. We've been here in many instances. Actually, the history of rounding up individuals labeled deviant is a feature that is accompanied not only the relationship of that hospitals have with prison systems, but also they're connected to some of the themes we talked about in the previous hour. As we talked about, for instance, the not only levels of bigotry, but also some of the features that take on a veneer of some form of war. In fact, as I went and looked through the report, it struck me that many of these men were in a situation in which their lives followed a lot of the classic features of prisoners of war.
Hmm. And, of course, there's a war against deviants, really.
Against deviants. What's remarkable, too, is that there's this notion that anything labeled deviants will bring in everything labeled deviants. So what one would find, for instance, that the idea that, say, the fact that this little girl was killed did not bring all heterosexuals on trial, because heterosexuality is not labeled into the category of deviance. But the idea that homosexual as a category of deviance is going to lead to a situation of molesting children is absurd. But the very fact that it shows the slippery slope nature of this kind of phenomenon.
Yeah, Miller?
Well, yeah. I mean, during this period, gay men were sort of viewed – well, first of all, homosexuality was officially categorized as a mental illness. So what better place to be if you're mentally ill than a mental hospital? And at the same time, gay men were sort of – were seen as violent by nature, capable of doing these kinds of crimes. And preventive detention was sort of made sense. So in a sense, they were political prisoners, you could say. Mm-hmm. Who were basically warehoused in this mental hospital, get them out of town and destroy their lives, but the public would feel a little more secure.
The other thing that was particularly striking is that the gruesome murders seem to function more as an opportunity rather than a stimulant. In other words, as you pointed out, that some of the political dimensions of it were also connected to career aspirations of individuals in the government in Iowa at the time.
Right, absolutely. The governor of the state and this county attorney, who's today a federal judge, I might add.
Wow.
And unrepentant.
Completely unrepentant. It's interesting because he has a very liberal record as a federal judge. He was appointed by Jimmy Carter. The first decision that he made as a federal judge was the case of a transsexual who wanted the state of Iowa to pay for her sex change. And he ruled that, in fact, the state was obligated to do this. Mm. And this is very typical of his reputation. I mean, the police in Sioux City really dislike this guy. But yet he got his start by petitioning the court to put these 20 gay men in a mental hospital.
Mm.
It's fascinating.
We want to enter that mental hospital now with Harold McBride. Harold McBride is an 80-year-old hairdresser in California who was one of the men institutionalized in this mental hospital. And we should say Harold McBride is his pseudonym, and he wants to be called Harold McBride. Welcome, Harold McBride.
Thank you.
Now, Harold McBride, how were you picked up and sent to this place? What were the circumstances?
I was sitting in a bar at the hotel in Sioux City, visiting a friend of mine who was from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, who was also gay, and we were sitting there having a drink, and that's all there was to it. And they just came in and just said, "You're arrested. Supposed to show ID," and took us right to the jail.
And did they say why you were arrested?
No, they did not.
And you were not having sex with this man?
Oh, no.
You were just talking to him?
Talking.
And what happened then? Was there a judicial proceeding?
Yes, later. But at first I was so scared and so confused about what the heck was going on and thinking of my family And I brainwashed myself out of. I've forgotten and tried to forget a lot of it because it was so humiliating and so, to me, I call it dirty work.
And of course, and of course, you were a married man with two children,
right?
And all that came out, and so you were at a trial, and you were sent to
Mount Pleasant.
And what was it like in there in the psychiatric ward where you were incarcerated?
Well, at first it was just like a dungeon. It seemed to me we were just holed in there. Two to a room and no doors, naturally. I mean, I figured that. And you couldn't go anywhere without an escort, and they didn't have those. And it was just a very, very depressing at the beginning. And then they wanted to give us something to do. I'm talking when I say us, the entire group, to paint some of the other dirty, filthy, rotten wards. And I mean, the place was filthy. And we'd go from one floor to another floor, and the whole crew would paint it. The only bit of relaxation or anything resembling normal, being normal, was they had a band. It was very good, and on Saturdays or Fridays, they'd have dances, and we could dress up, and we could dance with some of the attendants, or we could dance with some of the attendants. I meant with the attendants' wives.
Yes, yes, right.
And or patients, if you wanted, but we didn't. I was lucky enough. I've always been a good dancer, and I found one of the attendants' wives could follow me. I really enjoyed it.
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
Did you see psychiatrists? Was there an effort to give you therapy to break you of your homosexuality?
I don't think he was a psychologist, a psychiatrist. I think he was a psychologist.
And what did he ask you? What was that like?
He would show me pictures of different things and ask me what my first thought was of that picture. And then he talked about just back and forth conversations on how I felt about the whole bit and how I felt about my family. And he was a wonderful, wonderful person.
Oh, he was a wonderful person.
He certainly was.
He was trying to bring you comfort.
Oh, absolutely. He was great. And his wife was great, too. And I still keep in contact with his wife. He's dead now. But I still keep in contact with her because we had such a good relationship. And they were very, very kind to me when my wife came to visit me.
Neil Miller, in his book, talks about a particularly, I don't know if sadistic is the word, but harsh guard, a Jim Blackwell. Do you remember him?
No.
Yeah. Well, he's quoted here as saying, "I'll make you men even if you aren't men."
Oh, yes. Yes, I do remember that statement, but I don't remember the person. I remember hearing that, and that's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah. Harold McBride, you never told your partner of 21 years about this, or your kids. How come?
I guess I was ashamed to.
Yeah. Even your partner, that is to say, your homosexual partner.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even
no,
though...
I never told him, and I never told my kids, the older ones, there was three of them. And the two older ones, I'm sure, probably remember. And I completely try to forget it.
Yeah, it was so painful and so shameful.
Absolutely.
Harold McBride, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
Harold McBride, one of the people who was incarcerated in the Sioux City Mental Hospital, a story told in Neil Miller's book. We're going to be right back. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking to Neil Miller, who's a lecturer of journalism at Tufts and the author of Sex, Crime, Panic, A Journey to the Paranoid Heart of the 1950s, a tale of how a climate of opinion can become a climate of fear and a reality of persecution, this of homosexual men in the 1950s. Also with us is our news analyst, Lewis Gordon, the chairman of the Africana Studies Department at Brown University. Neil Miller, take us into this. How did you find out about the story? Has this been suppressed? And sort of take us through how you went about putting the book together, the people you talked to, the difficulties you had.
Well, I first came upon this when I was researching a gay history book that I wrote called Out of the Past, and I was kind of leafing through some gay magazines of the 1950s, published by the Mattachine Society, which was the first U.S. Gay rights organization, and I came across a little squib about this case, you know, a couple of murders, men rounded up, put in a mental hospital. And I was fascinated by it. I mean, the 1950s were a pretty bad time to be gay. There was a lot of entrapment. There were raids on gay bars. You were fired from the federal government if it turned out that you were gay. It was really a time of persecution of gay men. But I had never come across something where a large group of people were put into a mental hospital. So I went out to Sioux City and basically started researching this. I mean, names of the men were mentioned in the Sioux City Journal. I went to got their court records. I traced them through the city directories, tried to get in touch with them. Many of them had moved. Some were dead. Some I couldn't find. But I managed to find three of them, including Harold, that I really spent a lot of time with. There were five altogether.
Who were surviving,
yeah. And three who were really willing to talk to me. It was, as he says, it was such a shameful thing that they had really tried to put out of their minds. And in many cases, they just blocked a lot of it out. And there were people like the wife of the psychologist, Jackie Yamahiro, who I also contacted, who were extremely helpful. I interviewed a police officer who had entrapped some of these people.
And how did he go about that, did he say?
Well, there were all sorts of ways. I mean, he, for example, told me this story of how he went to this bar in the Warrior Hotel in Sioux City, which was kind of a gay hangout, met this man, went back to his apartment, pretended that he was willing to have sex with him. The man put his hand on his leg. The cop immediately took out his badge and said, "You're pinched." Now, the actual guy who was the sort of victim of this entrapment told the opposite story, that in fact they'd had sex, and then the police officer had said, "You're pinched." But anyway, but he gave me a whole a working plan of how he would do this. You know, you'd arrest the first homosexual, you'd pressure him to give another name, you'd bring him in, you'd get a name from him, and that's sort of how they came up with their 20 people. And this police officer was completely unrepentant and, you know, sort of loved telling me these stories. He had a scrapbook of all his exploits. And it was actually through him that I learned that there had been another roundup a few years later, when this district attorney was running for Congress, and these people were not put in a mental hospital, but they were all arrested and, you know, sort of went through a lot of the same traumas that the men 3 years earlier had. But working on this book was really a lot of detective work. I mean, I really had to track people down. In Sioux City, there were people remember the murders that precipitated it, but people either didn't remember this roundup, didn't want to talk about it. It was just one of these kind of town secrets, really, that people just didn't want to deal with. And I'm sort of looking forward to going out to Sioux City at the end of March to do a reading and a talk. And I'm still trying to get the Sioux City paper to interview me. So far, they don't seem too eager.
We should specify that these men were released after some months, and partly just because of the expense of keeping them. It wasn't some big feeling that we'd done something wrong here in essentially throwing guiltless men into prison.
Right, although they all have certificates that state they were cured.
Louis Gordon, we'd all like to have such a certificate, wouldn't we?
Indeed.
But not at that price.
Not at that price at all.
And presumably this has hurt them in the year, their trauma, guilt, difficulties.
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, many of them were wrenched from their families. I mean, Harold is an example. Mm-hmm. He had a beauty salon in a little Iowa town. He had to leave the town. He lost his job. Mm-hmm. You know, he had to close his business. He eventually moved to California. A lot of them left the state afterwards. Mm-hmm. It obviously had a tremendously negative effect on them and just made them, you know, certainly extremely paranoid and fearful and completely disrupted their lives.
Go ahead, Louis.
I was just thinking one could also imagine a larger chilling effect. I mean, that was a period of obsession over normality. And mm-hmm. as we know, whenever such purges occur, what often flees as well is the talent of the community, because in many ways, part of exemplifying one's abilities, one's talents, is standing out in ways that defy or stretch the categories of what is considered normal. I found it, for instance, curious, beyond the question of their homosexuality, any act of deviating from what's considered a normal way in which men and women would behave together was suspect. So in a situation like that, yeah, one of the things that really struck me is when we made the correlation with the prisoner of war analogy, one thinks, for instance, of a situation of where, you know, the Nazis made sure that what left Germany was pretty much a lot of talent that came to the United States.
They were lucky enough to survive. You know, one's impulse is to say of this, well, this was 1950s paranoia. It can't happen here. It can't happen now. But, says our next guest, it has happened here in Massachusetts. Welcome to Dorothy Rabinowitz. She's the editorial writer of the Wall Street Journal, and she's written extensively on the Fells Acres Daycare Center case. Hello. Hello. We haven't reached her. Well, we hope to have her, but she's not there. Yeah, of course, this is the way this case resonates right now. I mean, people have, for one thing, in Boston now, we have actual sex crimes committed by priests. And to say this hysteria would be really, I think, wrong. It isn't so much hysteria as warranted fear. These things are now, if hysteria seems to say imagined problems, this is a real problem. And our governor just the other day found that she could not pardon the remaining culprit in the Fells Acres case because of the climate of opinion. It would to pardon a child molester or to convicted child molester now would be politically difficult in Massachusetts, don't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Given the atmosphere, and in this case, it's perhaps a more justified situation, far more than back in the 50s.
Yeah.
Clearly,
yeah. I think we have Dorothy Rabinowitz with us now, do we?
Yeah.
Well, hi.
Hi.
Well, have you been hearing this?
No.
Well, okay. I was saying that our impulse is to say this was yesterday. It can't happen here. You say it has happened here in Massachusetts.
Yes.
Tell us your side of it.
Well, it's not my side. I think the entire legal establishment of Massachusetts, with the exception of the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, now understands that this is a travesty. And the most important lawyers magazine, Lawyers Weekly, called it a travesty, the entire affair. The whole thing, I have to say.
Can you just set it up for our listeners,
yes,
just with a few sentences? What is the whole thing?
Well, the whole thing is that, yeah, I began writing about the Amerald family in 1995. 4 months later, the Mrs. Amerald, elderly by then Mrs. Amerald, they were the owners of, as you know, the Fells Acres Day Camp. The elderly mother, Violet, her adult daughter, Cheryl, and Gerald were all swept away in this fever of child abuse accusations, which held around the country, and these really spectacular headline-grabbing trials. And Scott Harshbarger, who was then the district attorney at Middlesex County, and who then went on to run into fame and who is now sitting around in a good government position then, held a spectacular trial, and the Amaralts were convicted and given Gerald as the male figure. Can I underline that? The mm-hmm. male figure. Same crimes, but the male figure, one can expect to get five times more than the rest of the family. And so, and this is, of course, this gender distinction has made a very crucial difference in Gerald Amaral's life. His years later now, his mother, his sister, his mother is now deceased. His sister spent years in prison. They were out after 8 years, but Gerald Amaral was given 30 to 40 years. And the prosecution, from Tom Riley on down to Martha Coakley and all of the successors, kept the faith and their determination to hold on to this conviction because the male figure was the emblem of their conviction and much easier to load on this pile of guilt. It was the same grotesque series of accusations that the parole board spoke of. I mean, those are virtually the words.
Right. The parole board unanimously recommended that after, 16 years in prison, he be released. Of course, the trial featured charges of children being chained to trees, raped with knives. It was a horrifying testimony. And your view is that this was sexual hysteria at work.
My view. It's now the general view of virtually everybody except a strong handful of advocates, political advocates and people. The whole thing should remind everybody of the old joke about why is it that when Joseph Stalin gave speeches, the applause never seemed to stop? And the answer was always, the joke answer was always, everybody was afraid to be the first person to stop clapping. And that's the same in the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts. It's the same with the governor. Everybody by now knows what literally every editorial page in Massachusetts has called for Gerald Amaral's release. That's saying a great deal. Things have really changed. But in the end, the political fever still points to holding on to this male figure.
Right. Well, it's been very bad timing because this comes just in the middle of a current sex scandal. But, you know, the Boston Herald today wrote, and they pointed to the fact that these people, these young people are now grown up, and and they say this happened, and they all say by their story. And the Herald writes, if the public is to believe the allegations of young men molested decades ago in the priest's case, can it disregard the memories of former children from Fells Acres?
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, murders are committed every day. Doesn't mean because murders are committed that everybody accused of murder is guilty. I mean, if you look at the difference between the priest's cases, and we have to use the word alleged here too, of course, since we don't know these individual cases. You have in Fells Acres children with these grotesque accusations of being tied up naked in public, of you know, having bluebirds chopped up, of being forced on the face of it, fantasies. You have a very different thing going on in these priest molestation accusations where straightforward sexual cases. So the element of bizarre fantasy. Number two, the Amaralts conducted themselves over 20 years at this day school with not a single accusation. And it's quite typical of people who are child molesters that you have a lifetime of accusations and a long, long pattern. So the difference could not be greater. But, of course, the Herald was right in one regard, and that is that children who are told that these things happen to them was the case in Fells Acres. They were literally instructed by the prosecutors. Why would they not go on thinking that this happened to them? And indeed, as they grew up older and older, they'd suffered so much, they'd heard so much. And I am not the least bit surprised that they hold on to it with more ferocious, belief than ever before.
And, of course, in this case, Neil Miller points out that drugs were used to sort of in the trial and the judicial proceedings of some of the people arrested in this case in Iowa, homosexual men, and in the Fells Acres case, interview techniques were used. Also, sort of state-of-the-art psychiatry or psychology.
Well, yes, the whole, pardon the expression, the whole helping profession of a certain kind lent its itself to this new belief that all of these children were molested. People, little children who went happily to school every morning for 2 years, but who were supposedly tortured and cut with knives and huge butcher knives stuck in them, and no one noticed anything. You compare this to a straight case of sexual molestation. He touched me. You never got that in these cases. It was always satanic terrorization by old Violet Amaral. And the fact, of course, that the parole board pointed out properly that all these cases around the country were the same. They had the same grotesque evidence. They've all been overturned. They've all been discredited completely. But only in Massachusetts have they held on to it with this death rattle.
Mm.
But you know what? It'll be over. There is an inevitability about justice in America and elsewhere, and it will emerge.
Neil Miller, you feel the echoes of this case in your own story of the Sioux City men?
Well, there's definitely the same kind of hysterical atmosphere, and politicians kind of holding on to a certain position through all this.
Same situation there, where through the years the politicians stayed by their story and continued to.
Right, absolutely.
These men were guilty. We sent them to prison.
Right.
The hospital.
They certainly said, it was the town. It was important for the town of Sioux City that they be gotten away. And, there was this law, and that's just and we used it.
And there was this climate, this fear about the other and about difference.
Right. Yeah.
And Dorothy Rabinowitz is saying that in the 1980s, there was a fear about the innocence of children being invaded. Was that part of what you're saying here in the 80s? And did this have to do with daycare, the institution of daycare and its place?
I know people say that. I mean, it's one of the arguments I heard. I really don't think people are out to undo daycare, as many people have charged, particularly women. But I think that this was one of these things that just got blown up, the whole era of victimization. Child abuse and women who were attacked by their husband and all of this. And women and children, one could link them. And always there is this great figure of the male offender. And if you didn't have a male offender, they threw in the wife and the sister. But it became a cause celeb. And of course, everyone knows that there is child abuse.
Mm. Dorothy Rabinowitz, stay with us for a minute. We'll be right back. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about sexual witch hunts in 1950s Iowa, perhaps in 1980s Massachusetts. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. One of our guests is Neil Miller, the author of Sex, Crime, Panic, A Journey to the Paranoid Heart of the 1950s. We also with us is Lewis Gordon, our news analyst tonight. He's the director of the Africana Studies Department at Brown University. And we also have Dorothy Rabinowitz with us, who is an editorial writer at the Wall Street Journal. Dorothy, just very briefly, you have written that this case sort of ranks with some famous Massachusetts cases. You've had editorials with the titles Darkness in Massachusetts, which, of course, harkens back to the Sacco and Vanzetti case of the late 1920s, and beyond that to the Salem witch trials. Do you think we will come to regard this case in that way?
I've always been a little cautious about that, although a lot of my colleagues at the paper are much firmer on this. I think that I'd prefer to stay with the moment. I laughed when the governor issued a proclamation exonerating the Salem witch trial victims not long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And as I ended up writing one of my pieces, would that she could pick up and find something for one of the living victims of a current victim.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the interesting thing about this is how far a case like this can travel around the world. I mean, people write to us from New Zealand, from all around the country. It's true we have a huge readership around the world as well as around the United States. Mm-hmm. But there is something about the size of this one man twisting slowly in the wind while every single crevice and corner in which it is possible to squeeze out some political cowardice goes to work to keep him from this obviously innocent man in prison. And we see it again. Mm. What to Jane Swift is one man's life?
Indeed.
That's the question.
Dorothy Rabinowitz, thank you very much. Thank you for joining us.
All right.
Dorothy Rabinowitz is an editorial writer for The Wall Street Journal. Let's take a call from Michael. Michael is on the line. Michael? Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for Neil Miller. I'm in the middle of his book, which is kind of a great detective story, and it's very gripping. Thanks for writing it. But I'm just wondering if you, I mean, since we're talking about trends in witch hunts and so on that seem to swing from one extreme to another, do you see anything in the current climate? I mean, are we going back into another period when this is likely to emerge again? I know there was recently that case in Rhode Island of entrapment of some men in a adult bookstore or something. And it seems to me with the current administration and the fear about terrorism and so on, I mean, is this an active threat, do you think?
Yeah, Miller?
Well, there are sort of two different issues. Interestingly, the first case that you mentioned was in Johnson, Rhode Island, where a group of men were arrested about a month ago, I believe, in an adult bookstore, apparently engaged in some in sexual acts, and their names and addresses were all published in the Providence Journal, and one of them committed suicide. A week later, he was a town official in Connecticut. So that sort of thing certainly goes on. One could argue that this whole idea of preventive detention of, let's say, hundreds of Muslims after September 11th is, slightly in the same category as what happened back in the 50s, the same idea that, you keep people locked up as a way of trying to protect the public. And I wouldn't want to make the connections too exact or the parallels too exact, but I think these things go on. It's interesting that when Harold McBride was talking about the one psychologist in the mental hospital who he liked so much, that man was named Roy Yamahiro, and he was a Japanese-American who had been interned during World War II in an internment camp. And here he was, kind of the jailer in a similar situation. And he was obviously very sympathetic to the men, which was kind of an irony in that particular case. Mm-hmm. But I think what happened in the 50s definitely has echoes today in different ways, although the parallels, I think one can push them a little too far sometimes.
Lewis Gordon, you on the parallels to today, mm-hmm. not only the marginalization of gay men, I mean, certainly that is a reality still.
Yes, it is. Well, it's funny when we talk about the parallels, as Rabinowitz brought up the Stalin example. Although Bush may not be Stalin, the State of the Union had a lot of applauses under the camera. And as I think through this...
part of the ritual, though, right?
Part of the ritual, yeah. In other words, the chairs continue. But one of the things that struck me is her point about the male being emblematic of this period. This is something I could say as a college professor. There's been a spate of books, particularly in the past 20 years, that can be summarized in with the following set of theses. One of them is the normalizing of neurosis. In other words, to create a situation in which if one is not a victim, there's something wrong with one. And then another set of texts which can be summarized in all the evils born from daddy. If we put them together, what we begin to find is a narrative that begins to deal with a society that's dealing with anxiety over authority and the question of the extent to which authority, if there's anything that goes wrong in the society, it means authority must have failed and needs to be reasserted. In many ways, from the Iowa case all the way even to some of the things we're seeing right now in post 9/11, there's a desperate effort for institutions to somehow meet some mythic guaranteed sense of a solidified authority that will secure the future.
Excuse me.
No, I was just saying, and I see a lot of connections there because the McCarthy period was also dealing with this mythic notion that somehow if authority can be solidified, and according to some mythic test of what would be normal, as you know, a normal standard, what would happen is that there would be a more secure polity.
Kind of rituals of normalization that we engage in. The father must be strong. And, of course, he mentions the McCarthy period. Neil Miller, naming names was a big feature of that.
It certainly was. And it was a big feature of this case in which, you know, you sort of trap the first homosexual, get him to name a name, and somebody else names a name, and you're off, as that police officer put it. So I think very much the McCarthy period is you know, perhaps coming back today in certain respects.
Thank you. Thank you, Neil Miller. Neil Miller is lecturer of journalism and nonfiction writing at Tufts and is the author of Sex, Crime, Panic, A Journey to the Paranoid Heart of the 1950s. Thank you also to our news analyst, Lewis Gordon. He's director of Africana Studies at Brown University.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To read the prologue of Neil Miller's book, Sex, Crime, Panic, go to our website. The address is onpointradio.org.
What is another characteristic that we can attribute to Ibrahim, or that we know about him and we can describe and talk about?
He's trying to bring all these people together. Most likely these people are going to hold him as their role model.
These are the voices from a classroom at the Alhambra Academy, an Islamic elementary school in Northborough, Massachusetts. Dr. Mohammed Lazuni is the school's co-founder and one of its teachers. Since September 11th, his commitment to the principles of Islamic education has never been more strongly felt. In this radio diary, we hear from Dr. Lazuni and some of his students about building character and building bridges in the classroom.
Part of the Muslim tradition in general is that the idea of seeking knowledge, the idea of striving to seek knowledge, is very central to the faith. It's very central to the tradition. The first verse that was revealed in the Holy Quran was not a commandment to abstain from something, nor was it a commandment to go and do something specific. It was directly related to knowledge. So read was the very first ever revealed verse of the scripture of the Quran. The philosophy of the whole school is based on a rather simple idea. What we try to do here is we try to approach education from the standpoint of being a mechanism that allows us to build character. One of the significant things in terms of civic education is the challenge that we all had to go through after the September 11 event on how do you express loyalty to your community and how do you express patriotism to your whole nation and how do you express a large number of things. And it became interesting to try and explore these things in order to turn them into a positive force. What happened is that a number of the Islamic schools around the country are obviously tied in into the networks of other schools around them. So the first reaction that happened to everybody, we are not going to make a distinction between who is a Muslim student and who is not. They are all children, and all of these children need care, and these are scary times, and we need to simply come together in order to make a better environment for them to feel that they are secure. That thought process motivated most of the schools that were around the Islamic school to realize that this is a time where the Islamic schools are likely to be more victimized than others. So automatically found themselves proactively coming in and saying, what is it that we can do to make things better, or how do we open the door such that the children do not feel isolated and do not feel that they are an outcast from a larger community?
We've actually went to a couple of schools since September 11th to talk about, you know, how almost Islam and terrorism is of no relation. I was surprised that people were very accepting of our religion, and they were very curious to find out what Islam was actually preaching, because normally the media depicts us as very, very violent people. But a lot of people wanted to know what the truth was behind Islam. So when we went to the schools, they found out.
The moment the children saw that their particular school was an object of curiosity rather than an object of threat, it changed their whole mentality from having them feeling guilty by association to having them feeling more like they are part of a larger thing.
I wear the scarf everywhere I go, and it's something that I know and that I've also asked my parents about, so it's like nothing I talked about I didn't know, so it was really easy for me to just explain it to other people. And we did get a lot of questions, a lot of people were really curious about it. Like, no one was treating us in a bad way, no one made any comments, they were listening to us and they were asking questions, and a lot of people were really into it.
It was important for a lot of people who were outside our particular school to realize that these were not children that were brought from somewhere else. These were exactly like them. And we're talking about Americans born here, grew here, who knew of no other language, who knew of no other experience, and who knew of no other thing but their country. So people started realizing that that's an important idea.
Well, when it first happened, like September, the attack on the World Trade Center, I was really afraid that everybody would just be like, oh my God, she's wearing a scarf, she's a terrorist, and I was like really scared. But then, like after I just started talking to the children, I realized that there are people out there who actually care about us, and that really like relieved me.
I have always felt that my life would never be complete if somehow I don't get this wonderful chance of being useful to future generations by either teaching them into the classroom or doing whatever it takes to basically make their life better. I came to the realization at this particular time is really as far as where we are going into the future. We need to realize something is if we are able to turn our schools from these almost automatons to schools where we instill something that is much bigger than simply imparting information, but really imparting knowledge and wisdom, then we are likely to do a better job in the future of everything, of just about everything, to just make a better world tomorrow.
That was Dr. Muhammad Lazuni and two of his students, Rashima Binatisha and Reda Muhammad, from the Alhambra Academy in Northborough, Massachusetts. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Are events in the news impacting you in a personal way? If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org, or send your diary by mail to onpoint, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. That's onpoint, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can read or listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarti, Nate Dimio, Eileen Yamada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Darren Manoogian, Tim Monroe, and Laura Tanguso. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. WBUR's executive producer of national programs is Ian Doherty. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Jack Beattie. This is On Point.